Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, Tim Powers. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. And I am your host, Edward Willett, also a writer of science fiction and fantasy. This is a special Kickstarter month edition of The World Shapers. As I record this, and for the next 8 days, as this goes live on Sunday, March 22nd, I'm running a Kickstarter to fund an anthology of fiction from some of the first-year guests of this podcast. And so we're talking original fiction from Shannon McGuire, Tanya Huff, David Weber, L.E. Modisett Jr., Christopher Rocchio, D.J. Butler, John C. Wright, Shelley Adina, and me, and reprints from John Scalzi, David Brin, Fonda Lee, Julie Cherneda, Gareth L. Powell, Derek Kunskin, Dr. Charles E. Gannon, and Thorea Dyer. I don't think I forgot anybody. It's a great lineup of fiction, and we're getting close. So if you're listening to this in that last week of March, please check out the Kickstarter at tinyurl.com/shapersofworlds, and you will find that Kickstarter campaign, or you can, of course, go to Kickstarter and just do a search for Shapers of Worlds, and you'll find it there. Looking for $13,500 Canadian, which is about $10,000 US. More than half of that will go to pay the authors, because I'm paying professional rates. And there are great backers rewards being offered. For example, Fonda Lee has sets of her two YA books, XO and Crossfire, in hardcover, signed sets of those available. There's an opportunity to get 14 hours, 2 days worth of listening of, maybe it's more than that, seven books. Yeah, it'd be more than that. It's seven audiobooks from Julie Cherneda are also one of the higher level ones. I'm offering short story critiques and even a mentorship if you really want to shell out. So please check out the campaign. Of course, the basic rewards will be copies of the anthology once it comes out, either in print or in ebook form. And there's a lot of other ebooks and all sorts of other things in there for backers. So please check out the Shapers of Worlds Kickstarter live now through noon Eastern on March 30th. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about that right now. Let's get on to this episode's guest, Tim Powers. So, Tim, welcome to the World Shapers.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
We met, we happened to be side by side at World Fantasy this year at the mass signing, and I took the moment to to reach out and say, hey, want to be on my podcast? So I'm glad you said yes.
Yeah, it sounded like fun.
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of interesting people, so I'm glad to add you to the list. Now, I always start, it's almost a cliche on the podcast, I'll say that I'm going to take my guests back into the mists of time, which is actually kind of appropriate for some of your fiction. But in this case, it's your mists and your time. So going back, give me a little bit of your biographical background and how you first became interested in, well, in writing, but in writing fantastical stories in particular.
Oh, well, let's see. I was born in Buffalo, New York. And when I was seven, the family moved out here to Southern California, which I was glad of because I don't ever want to see snow in person again.
You're talking to somebody who lives in Saskatchewan. So.
Ha, yeah. But when I was, I don't know, a little kid, I read a book called Timothy Turtle about a turtle who gets turned on his back and can't get right side up again till his woodland pals help turn him over. And I think at that point I decided writing such things was about the best thing a person could do. And I became a big reader, and for example, I was a big fan of Albert Payson Terhune. Wrote books about Collies, which I still mean to go back to because I remember they were really great. But when I was 11, my mom got me a copy of Heinlein's Red Planet.
Oh, yeah.
And that polarized me and fixed all the dials in one position, and I went on to read every Heinlein I could find and then noticed that other people wrote this stuff too and moved on into everybody, Theodore Sturgeon, Fritz Leiber, and so forth. And I suppose until I was in college, I really read nothing but science fiction and fantasy. And these days, really, I think for new books, I mostly read spy novels, police, courtroom type stuff. Michael Connelly, I think, is my favorite living author at the moment. But all that science fiction fantasy reading in my youth kind of set my pattern, like it was wet cement that got imprinted and hardened, so that to this day I can't think of a plot to write that is not science fiction fantasy.
Red Planet was one that really kind of cemented my interest too. I remember it very well and reread it not that long ago and still enjoyed it, even though the science, of course, is long superseded.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I never mind that. A lot of Heinlein's juveniles, for example, which are, my favorites of his books, Mars has canals, Venus has jungles, but that doesn't bother me a bit. I guess I sort of subconsciously tell myself, well, it's alternate Mars, alternate Venus. And once you grant him those basic errors, they are hard science fiction, you know, of the time.
Yeah, and they certainly were what got me interested in science to a certain extent as well, with some of those Heinlein juveniles, so, because that was always an interest of mine growing up as well. But when you went to a university, you actually studied English literature, which is always interesting to me because I ask writers about their study of whether they've studied writing and studied that sort of thing or not, and whether it was beneficial or not. So I'm interested. And you were there for 6 years, I think, at university. So was that something that cemented your interest in writing?
Certainly showed me a much bigger landscape of available places you could go to, as it were. I'm glad I did it. Of course, in those days, you could go to college and not come out owing $50,000. I was able to just work summers as a janitor or at a pizza parlor and cover tuition. And so I stayed for 6 years to get a BA, just because I kept on finding interesting courses like medieval literature, 18th century drama. And I do think, of course, that for a writer, it's beneficial to have read as widely and from as many different centuries as possible, so you avoid getting stuck by default in the age you happen to live in with its default philosophies and assumptions. Especially valuable for a science fiction fantasy writer who theoretically does want to work from a bigger perspective than just what you see between here and the nearest 7-Eleven.
Well, and you also met some friends there that kind of led you into, who were also interested in this kind of stuff, didn't you? James Blaylock and K.W. Jeter?
Yeah.
Or is it Jeter? I've never known how to pronounce the name.
I believe it's Jeter. And it was a nice contrast because Jeter had grown up, like myself, immersed in science fiction. He even had a letter published in FNSF during the brief period when they had letters from readers. and came by way of Mark Twain, Jules Verne, Robert Louis Stevenson, and was new to modern American science fiction. And so the two of them provided a nice kind of spectrum. And we all three were writing stories and sending them out and getting them rejected and comparing notes and kind of kept one another devoted to it, really, as opposed to aiming at getting respectable jobs.
Did you take any formal writing classes in the literature degree?
Not really. I took one creative writing class just because I was taking every English class available. But I have kind of come to the conclusion that creative writing classes, much less creative writing major, are not really very valuable. The main value is it makes you do some writing, which otherwise laziness might prevent. But I think you pick up bad attitudes, especially in the university context. I think you pick up kind of a avant-garde, mainstream attitude, which may be great on a broader scale, but for popular fiction, whether it's science fiction, fantasy, or, thrillers, kind of popular literature, I think it can be kind of a handicap.
But you teach writing.
Yeah, I do. At a high school of the arts, and I hope I'm giving them the other kind of writing instruction, emphasizing plot, emphasizing the fact that at every page, the reader has the option of putting the book down and going to YouTube instead. And the writer's obligation to keep on holding the reader's interest so that it's, kind of a vice, really. Paul Anderson said that you're always competing for the reader's beer money. Mm-hmm. And I always try to keep that in mind and try to emphasize that kind of attitude with the students. So I do teach it too. I just like to think I do it from a more pragmatic, you might almost say mercenary, basis. I always tell them, you got to have books out there at Barnes & Noble with your name on them. That's worth anything.
I'm currently writer in residence at the Saskatoon Public Library here in Saskatchewan, and I find that looking at other people's, even though they're beginner writers for the most part, and well, almost entirely, but I still find that looking at their stuff critically actually helps me when it comes to looking at my own stuff with a more critical eye. Do you find that it's like that line from The King and I, if you become a teacher by your students, you are taught? Have you found that as a teacher?
Yeah. It's like I've many times taught at the Clarion workshop, and I always want to emphasize that when you got 18 people critiquing one person's particular story, the point, the value of the exercise is not to get that writer to improve that story. That might happen. It may be that that writer will pick up some good points and fix that story. But the main value was for the other 17 people in looking at an imperfect story and discerning what are the imperfections and how would each of them go about remedying those imperfections, and that way they can use that improved insight when they go back to looking at their own work. Damon Knight said that when he desperately wanted to get published, he kept getting stories rejected and then one sold, but he kept getting rejected. And he would look at that one story and think, what did it do right that all the rest of my stuff has not done right? And then he got a job reading slush at a magazine. And he read so many unpublished stories that it became obvious to him when a story was publishable and when it was not. It was almost as if they were printed in a different color ink. And so, yeah, there's a lot of value in looking at imperfect stories, which can ideally be perfected, but stories which are not yet perfect, and seeing how they need to be fixed, or at least where they went wrong. So, yeah, when I'm reading students' stories, I'll say, here's where you have gone astray. Here's what you don't have that stories need. And I'm always very encouraging about it. And, yeah, it does reemphasize in my own head those principles. And I do get a kick out of it. I love teaching at this high school. For one thing, they're kind of filtered students. They have to submit samples of their work, and then only a fairly small fraction are selected to actually be accepted into the program. So I get a grossly unrealistic view of modern teenagers. I think, you know, modern American teenagers are brilliant. And people say, Powers, no, you're not looking at a representative sample there.
Well, let's get back to your writing. How did you start getting published? People think of maybe The Drawing of the Dark or Epitaph in Rust, but you started with some books by, actually, I guess Epitaph in Rust was published by Laser, and I was interested because that's the Canadian connection.
That's right. They were part of the whole Harlequin empire.
I remember them. I remember those books, but I don't remember ever reading one. I just knew they existed.
Harlequin briefly decided to explore science fiction to see if it sold as well as romances. And after a couple of years, of course, they decided, no, it does not sell nearly as well as romances, and they shut it down. But during that brief period, K.W. Jeter heard about it and sold a couple of novels to them, and he told me, check this out. They're brand new. They pay very poorly. They have very strict length requirements and no backlog. Your odds are better here than, you know, Ace, Bantam, and so forth, Dell. And so I said that. He said also they'll give you a contract simply on the basis of three chapters and an outline. And I thought, well, the idea of writing a whole novel, even though that was only like 60,000 words, is daunting. But I could write three chapters in an outline. And so I did. And luckily, I wrote the first 10,000 words and showed it to Jeter. And he said, throw this in the trash. You have to start when the story starts. And I had started with 10,000 words of what I suppose I would have called introducing the characters, largely because 60,000 words seemed like such a lot that I thought I better start slow. So I took his advice and threw away that first 10,000 words and then did start with when the actual story action started. And I sent it off, and Laser did give me a contract, and so I wrote that book and then wrote another for them, and then they went out of business. But by that time, I had turned pro and had abandoned any thought of getting a master's degree or going on to be a college professor or anything like that. And so I went back and resumed my pizza parlor job and kept on sending manuscripts out. And I was virtually starting over again because somehow laser was not a credential. It was almost below the radar in the science fiction world in those days. But then luckily I sent a book to Lester Del Rey at Del Rey Books, and he said, I'm not accepting this, but I'm not actually rejecting it either. If you take it home and instead of 60,000 words, make it 120, and you don't have the character die at the end, and you don't have this missing year in the middle of the story, if you can close that gap, and a few other things, I might very well buy it. And that was the only encouragement I had, so I did what he said, and fortunately he did buy it. And that was, Drawing of the Dark, which was published in 79. And then he rejected every book after that that I sent him. But luckily, when he would reject a book, like he rejected Anubis Gates and Dinner at Deviant's Palace and On Stranger Tides, but every time he would reject a book, he would send me a 4-page single-spaced letter pointing out what was wrong with it. And I would read the letter and think, boy, he's right. These are all perfectly valid criticisms. I'm going to fix it. And I would tell him, thank you. I've fixed it. Do you want to see it again? And he'd say, no, I hate it. But those things I told you are what's wrong with them. So I would fix the book according to his critique, and then I would sell the books to Ace. So in a way, Lester Del Rey was my editor on those books because his criticisms, even though he didn't want to see the books again, were totally valid.
Well, I don't believe anybody has told me a story like that before of when they were getting started. Did those laser books, there's the famous quote by, I think it's Stephen King, that everybody writes 500,000 words of crap before they write anything publishable. Did the laser books, were you at least getting valuable experience as you were writing those, even if they somehow didn't count?
They counted for me.
Well, yeah, for you, of course, yeah.
Even though they didn't count for everybody. It was kind of a valuable apprenticeship in that it did occur, as I say, kind of off the radar. If I reread, for example, the first one, I can see a big improvement between chapter 1 and chapter 5, for example. Writing very steadily on one project, which was new to me, did teach me a lot of valuable things. And Laser was so high-handed, like if your book was too long, they would cut it for you. And if it was too short, they would have someone in the office add a few scenes to it. And any corrections you made in proofs were likely to be simply ignored. I think sometimes they just threw the returned proofs straight in the trash. And so after that, any behavior from publishers that I've had, in comparison, has seemed reasonable. Even the most outrageous behavior, I think, compared to Laser, this is really fairly mild. So yeah, I was lucky to be able to step in via Laser Books because it was an opportunity to kind of work through an apprenticeship that I don't think I could have found at Bantam, Ace, Del Rey. And I think Laser, but people collect Laser books now in retrospect because they did publish, they published Jerry Pournelle's first novel. And there was a Dean Koontz under a pseudonym. I think it served a valuable function. I, I like to think there are publishers today, even as I say it, I don't think it's true, but I would like to think there are publishers today that still serve that function, kind of a entry-level publication.
Well, I published with some bad publishers, but it's not quite the same thing. There was no editing in that one, so my first couple of books for the publisher that shall remain nameless.
You do need an editor. I was fortunate with Dale Ray, and I've been fortunate since with people like Beth Meacham, Jennifer Brell, and Tony Weisskopf, because... as you know, you finish a book, you look at it from all angles, you say, that's perfect, unimprovable. And then the editor says, how about these points? And you say, oh, yeah, I guess it wasn't so unimprovable after all. To the point where I would hate to have my original drafts published, because the critical eye of a trained and insightful editor really is one of the crucial steps in between first draft and ultimate publication.
Well, and we're going to go through the steps that you follow, because this podcast is all about the creative process. So, first of all, though, the books we're going to focus on are your two alternate routes and then the new one, which is Forced Perspectives. So can you give for those who inexplicably haven't read either one of them, can you give a synopsis?
Well, one just came out 2 days ago.
So it would be difficult, yeah.
go through what?
Just give a synopsis of what they're about.
Oh, yeah. I take the idea that humans having free will are contra-determinism. That in effect, every human with free will is a little pocket of supernatural violation of natural law, which is arguably true. And it occurred to me that when you have a whole bunch of moving free wills, such as on a freeway, moving past stationary free wills, such as a person sitting on the freeway shoulder, it's sort of like electrons, moving electrons past stationary electrons, like Faraday spinning a magnet inside a coil of wire, which generates the electromagnetic field. And I thought, what kind of field would be generated with people moving on a freeway? And I thought, well, any kind of field you want, Powers. Let's say it's a very indeterminist field, such that possibilities are expanded beyond reason, and so ghosts can show up alongside freeways to a distance of about a mile from the lanes. And it led from there to the idea that if a rogue government agency was using this phenomenon to add security to presidential motorcades, which sort of instantly occurs to one, of course, they might accidentally open a portal, conduit, gateway to some catastrophic other world. And so in the book, it turns out that's what's going on. And our hero, who is an ex-Secret Service agent who had to go into hiding because of a wrong accusation, winds up teaming with a woman from the agency that's using this ghost conjuring phenomena, and they have to prevent Los Angeles from being destroyed by the incursion of this looming other world. Ha! Oh, there we are. Ha! And in the second book, these two characters are thrown together again because Cecil B. DeMille buried the set of the Ten Commandments after he finished filming it in 1923. And DeMille claimed that the reason he buried the set was that he didn't want cheap movie companies coming along and using his sets for their low-budget movies. But I say the real reason is because he became aware that certain hieroglyph had been put up on the wall of the pharaoh's palace. And it turned out that was a very dangerous hieroglyph, and he needed to hide it, remove it, get rid of it. But a bad motorcycle gang in the 1960s dug it up and has been making bad use of it. And our poor characters from alternate routes get involved in this and find themselves forced to find out what's going on and stop it. And it has to do with, a lot to do with the kind of murderous atmosphere that was prevailing in Los Angeles in the late 60s, which culminated in the Manson murders, but had been led up to by a bunch of really weird occult motorcycle gangs and semi-satanic cults in the Hollywood Hills, and there was just kind of an atmosphere, even before Manson, of looming apocalypse. And luckily it seems to have burned out, but there was a real feeling of menace in those days. I remember Joan Didion said that when word of the Manson murders spread throughout the movie community, what she remembers is that nobody was surprised. Everybody had kind of subconsciously knew something like this was due. Anyway, I like to think that in those books, I make colorful use of the kind of mystical atmosphere of the freeways and the weird history of L.A. and Hollywood and the weird landscape with the Hollywood Hills and strange little canyons that can only be got to by hidden stairways and the kind of, I suppose, Raymond Chandler meets H.P. Lovecraft type atmosphere I kind of perceive in the area.
So this initial idea of the freeways and the sort of generating things, was there a spark for that? And on a broader term, is this typical of the way that your concepts come to you for books?
Well, it always starts with some nonfiction reading I'm doing. I'll be reading just for entertainment some factual book, and I'll come across some odd, anomalous detail, and I'll think, what's the story there? And then if I find a second or third odd detail, I think, okay, what's going on? And I don't mean what's going on in real life. I mean, what could you make of this fictionally? For example, for one of my books, I read that Edison's last breath is preserved in a test tube in a museum in Michigan. And I thought, well, that's odd. And then I read that in his old age, Edison announced that his next project would be a telephone that you could talk to dead people with. And I thought, okay, what's going on with Edison? And what I did then was read extensively about him with a kind of paranoid squint, looking for clues to some sort of supernatural business he might have been mixed up with. And with that kind of squint, you do find anomalies which in real life were simply meaningless happenstances. But if you're putting together a plot for a book, you say, aha, that was not a meaningless happenstance, or that over there was not a coincidence, or his overt reason for doing this here was not his real reason. What was actually going on was, and then you cook up your supernatural backstory. And this has the virtue of, for one thing, tying your story firmly in with actual events, so that I like to think it seems to be a bit more plausible than a supernatural structure that you simply impose on a historical situation. And also, it relieves you of the necessity of imagination. All you have to do is find the weird stuff and connect the dots.
Well, it sounds like you're basically making use of the well-known human predilection to finding patterns where there are no patterns, which leads to a lot of conspiracy theories and all that stuff.
So. Every bit of history provides plenty of odd little facts that mean nothing and go nowhere in real life. But for fiction, you said, aha, that is, it did mean something. It did go somewhere. Check this out.
So once you had your idea, and how do you go about developing? Are you a detailed outliner, or are you just a sketch it out and then start writing, or how does that work for you?
I am generally a very detailed outliner. I like, ideally, to know every single thing that's going to happen before I actually start writing. I know writers, better writers than me, who simply start. They put two characters in a car, driving, and they let the characters talk and conclude from what the characters say what the story is going to be. But for me, that would go nowhere. For one thing, by the time a story actually became evident by that system, and you did know what everything was about, you'd realize that a whole lot of the stuff you've written up to that point doesn't happen to be part of what you now see as the story and has to be ditched. And I hate ditching scenes I've written, so I want to make sure in advance that I don't write scenes that will wind up on the cutting room floor. And some people have said, well, that's boring. If you've already figured the whole story out and you're simply noting, expanding on, you know, a story you already have settled, that's no fun. But I see it as when I actually start writing, it's a stage, and now you actually have actors enacting what you pre-planned, and so you get to see them actually performing the actions you outlined, and so it is fresh. And in fact, of course, sometimes it happens that when you see it actually enacted, you think, oh, you know what, that doesn't work. As outlined event, that looked fine, but now that I see it actually performed, I can see, no, you got to go back and fix that up. So I do outline in advance, but as I actually write, it often becomes clear that the outlined version isn't going to work, and you got to go back and, in effect, re-outline.
Yeah, that's happened to me a few times. I'm not a detailed outliner, but I usually have maybe 10 pages or so of notes, and things change. So how long would your outline be?
Well, it can be 80 or 100 pages. It's just notes to myself. It's not an outline that anyone else could make sense of. I'll say, and here you have a confused situation like in that Modesty Blaze book, or here have a incident in a car like in that, some movie. It'll be references that only I would know what I was talking about. It'll include bits of conversation that occurred to me, or references to another file. I might say, this will involve this. Look, check out that file about, you know, Arab hospitality. It would look like a confused mess to anybody but me.
Now, once you actually start writing, what does your physical writing process look like? Do you write a certain number of hours a day in the same place? Do you move around? How does it work for you?
I always am sitting here at my desk with my computer in front of me, and I go from averagely 8 p.m. to midnight, and ideally I like to get 1,000 words, and then in the morning from about 8 to 10, I go over what I wrote the night before, fixing it up, making things clearer, expanding dialogues that got to the point too quickly, maybe, or were too expository. And then let it go till 8 p.m. I do like to middle of a scene. I don't like to stop, like, thud as the curtain comes down on the end of a chapter. Because then, next day, it's like getting a car to start by pushing it. It's too much starting from point zero again. I much prefer to be able to resume a scene that's already in progress. In fact, I like to stop work in the middle of a sentence. That way, next day, all I have to do to get moving again is finish a sentence, and I'm rolling. I constantly have to work against inertia. I always am too ready to look at the screen and think, oh, man, what am I going to write today? You know what? Look at that paperback on the ground. That old, Dick Francis novel. That shouldn't be on the ground. I should put that away. And I pick it up and I read the first page and I think, oh, you know, this was really good. And I'm too easily distractible.
Yeah, I know that feeling too. So once you have your, it sounds like if you're revising the bit that you wrote in the evening each morning, do you end up with a very clean draft or do you have a lot of revisions that you do yourself before it goes to the editor?
Well, let's see, call it a 100,000 word novel. About every 10,000 words, I'll go back to the beginning and reread up to the point that I'm at. And as I go back through, and it's a bigger and bigger lump that I'm going back through, for example, if I've got 60,000 words, I'll go back to the beginning again and read all the way up to that 60,000 word point. I'll find hints that I dropped early on that, in fact, led nowhere. And cut them. I'll find repetitious conversations. I'll find areas where, looked at from a bit of a distance now, I can see it wasn't clear or it wasn't clear enough. I need more smells, colors, echoes, things like that. And so by the time I finish, the early section of the book has been pretty thoroughly reworked, but the last 10 and 20,000 words haven't got the kind of constant recombing that the early parts had. So I kind of have to put it away for a month or a week or so, and then come back and give those last 10 or 20 or 30,000 words the kind of continuous or repeated attention the early parts got. And then, ideally, I'll read the whole thing and I'll think, okay, that's unimprovable. That's perfect. And I send it off and the editor will come back and say, it's very nice, Powers, but what about these problems? And I'll think, oh, yeah, huh, who knew? Also, as I go, not every day, but certainly every week, I have my wife read what I've written. And she's a perfect, what they call, beta reader, because she's a big reader, very well read, and not a writer. So she tells me a reader's problems with it. I really don't ever want to get criticisms like that from another writer, because inevitably another writer would simply tell me how they would have written it.
Yeah.
I know when I've given what I think is beautiful criticism to writers. One time, Nalo Hopkinson was in a Clarion class, and I told her exactly how to make her story perfect. And she didn't do it, and went on and sold her story. And it occurred to me, no, Powers, what you told her was how to make it a power story, which isn't what she set out to do.
Yeah, I have to be careful with that, doing the writer-in-residence stuff. I know that sometimes my inclination is to take the story and mold it the way I would mold it, and that's not right, you know.
And sometimes you think it would be better.
Well, I'm sure it would be better sometimes, but, you know, that's not what I'm there for. I'm just trying to help them.
Right.
So, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
So what kind of, you sort of vaguely mentioned, but what kind of things are typically in your, when the editor comes back with suggestions, what sort of things do you find that maybe you've skimmed over or that need more work?
Sometimes the editor will say, we already get this. You don't have to re-emphasize that this character dislikes that character. or you certainly don't have to emphasize it as overtly. Often an editor will say, these are normal people, your characters. Here is a supernatural intrusion. They're not astonished enough. How would you react, Powers, if suddenly, you know, gross supernatural intruded on your life? I think you'd be more surprised than what you have your characters here being. Like, oh, yeah. Sometimes they'll say the ending is too rushed. It's like you saw the end in sight and sort of started to sprint toward it. Slow down. Be as leisurely in the last tenth of the book as you were leading up to that. And these are all very valuable. I think, oh, yeah, I guess I did do that. Thank you. I would be very embarrassed to have the original, what I thought was perfect version, published.
Yeah, I think I mentioned off the top, as we're recording this afternoon, I'll get my call from Sheila Gilbert at Daw Books for my next novel, and that's...
Oh, yeah.
And I think, it was pretty good. I thought it was pretty good when I sent it off, but I know she's going to talk to me for 2.5 hours and tell me why it needs more work, so. Yeah. And she always improves it, and so...
Yeah, I know. They'll send a letter or email with 10 points, and I always find that 5 of them are crucial, yes, gross improvements. I don't know how I didn't think of it myself. 3 will be, I guess that'd be a little better. I'll do it. And 2 that don't apply, are unworkable. I think, well, no, you can't do that. We can't. The guy's dead by that time, okay? You can't do that. And I always think they put in those last 2 inapplicable suggestions just to give you the satisfaction of not down the line 100% taking their advice.
Well, on the current books, was there anything specific that came back?
There was a point where in Alternate Roots where the male character gets in big trouble, and gets out of it. And the editor said, here's the female character standing right there. Why not have her participate in him getting out of the trouble? Not so much because one ought to have strong female characters, though that too, but because you want to have them be parallel. You want to have them be a team sharing the work, sharing the responsibility, sharing the credit, sharing the... participating fully in the partnership. And I thought, oh yeah, of course, right. And then always plausibility. They'll always say, this seemed like you pulling strings. Go back and make it more of a natural consequence. Put in some stuff earlier such that this trick you pull will make the reader think, oh, yes, of course, rather than, huh, or I'm so sure.
When I talk to writers, some of them are worried about being edited, and I always say that, well, editors are just as invested in making the book a success as you are.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
You're all on the same team.
Yeah, now, of course, always the first reflex you have is, No, you don't need that. But then after a few seconds, you think, well, mainly you don't want to do more work on something you consider done. But after a few seconds, you think, yeah, I guess you're right. You hear of writers who get so celestially successful that they simply declare, I am not going to be edited anymore. And I think when you look at examples of that, the books turn out to be real fat, real self-indulgent and kind of arbitrarily plotted. And I think, no, you know what? You made a mistake ditching the editor.
Yeah.
Humbling as it is, it's always valuable. In fact, that's one of my main objections to self-publishing. You don't get an editor unless you hire one. And it's such an important, crucial function that if I was doing it, I would feel bound to hire the very best possible editor on the planet, the way you would hire the very best possible attorney if you were arrested for murder. And I think that would be costly. And I always think it should not cost a writer anything to get a book published.
Even a mediocre editor is fairly costly, so...
Yeah, and why do that when you get that service free? In fact, you get the service free and money from a real publisher.
Always been my preference. Now, we're getting close to the end of my hour here, so I want to move on to the big philosophical question, which is basically, why do you do this? Why do you write? And why do you think any of us write? And specifically, why this kind of stuff?
Well, we can be happy consumers of lots of things. Restaurants we love, movies we love, painters whose work we love. But somehow, when writers, people who are going to be writers, read books, it's not enough simply to have paid the money and be grateful for the work. We want to do it too. You know, you think, oh, I love that, now I want to do it. And I never think that with a restaurant or a sculpture or a movie. I may love it, but I never think, I got to make a sculpture. But when I read books, I think, oh, I want to do that too. And to a large extent, I mean, you may write because you have things to say about the human condition or oppressed populations, or you want to paint a portrait of your time or outline your own sufferings. Those are all fine if you want to do those. But I always think the main motivation to writing fiction is to show off. It's so when people come to your house, you can say, sit down. Oh, let me move that off the couch. It's copies of my new novel.
Which just happened to be sitting there.
Yeah. I think to a very large extent, it is the desire to show off.
This podcast is called The World Shapers. Do you hope that your fiction, maybe shaping the world is a little grand, but do you hope that it affects people in some way? Changes them?
No, I don't think it will. We can all think of books that did change the world, affected the way people think, speak about some issue. We can think of Heinlein, William Gibson, things they wrote that became part of the culture. But I mainly just aim to give them an entertaining ride. Now, of course, any piece of fiction longer than 4 pages will have some sort of theme, but I never think about that when I'm writing. I worry a lot about the plots, but I never worry about what is it you have to say, Powers. I think, well, you know, these vampires were chasing this guy. If people ask me, well, what theme do you feel you're exploring in your work, Powers? I always say, nobody wins when you play games with traffic safety, which I ripped off from a Dave Barry book. If there are any broader themes in my books, they're spontaneous and from my subconscious, and I'm not aware of them. Mainly what I want to do is provide a lively supernatural adventure story.
Which you have done many times. How many books are you up to now?
This new one's my 16th.
And what are you working on now?
Actually, I'm working on a third book about those two characters. I am a little bit into it already. And it would be nice if I had it done by the end of the year. It's probably unrealistic, but it'd be nice. And after that, I don't know, I'm thinking maybe another historical thing. I've been looking at Europe in the 1920s.
Well, lots to look at there.
Yeah, I love a rich field of research. I love a target-rich environment.
So when you're not working on fiction, and is most of your reading these days more likely to be nonfiction?
A third nonfiction, a third science fiction, a third Michael Connelly type stuff. And I gotta admit that when it comes to fiction, a pretty big percentage of it is rereading. And since I do that naturally, I like to think it's valuable. And I do think there is value in rereading fiction you've read before, because the first time you're just a happy passenger goggling at the scenery, but the third or fifth time you read a fiction book, a good one, you're a writer noticing the foundations and the superstructure and the wiring and all that stuff.
When you teach writing, do you recommend books or do you just recommend reading?
Cheerful, open enough, as opposed to, I've found, college students, that they will read what you recommend. High school student, you tell them, here, read this book. Okay. And they read it, and they come back, that was really good. What else you got? I've probably what I do is inculcate them with my own tastes and prejudices, but I think they'll be contrary to what they'll pick up in college, and therefore a good contrast.
And where can people keep tabs on you?
Let's see. There's a website which is maintained by a very generous, accommodating guy, which is theworksoftimpowers.com. And I'm on Facebook if you want to see pictures of my cats.
You're not active on social media otherwise, are you?
No. I'm kind of a digital immigrant, as opposed to people born since 1990. Things like Twitter, I just think, no, I ain't doing it.
I'm on it, and I think that just about every other day anyway. So.
Yeah, I think these days, I hope it's not true, but I get the idea that if you're an upcoming writer these days, you kind of have to have an internet footprint.
That's what they say.
Yeah, I hate to think that's true.
Well, your internet footprint is large enough considering you have lots of books, and the book footprint is more important than the internet footprint.
Yeah, yeah. I think somebody with my attitudes, I was lucky I came in when I did.
Well, thanks so much for being on the World Shapers. I enjoyed the chat. I hope you did too.
Well, thank you, Ed. Yes, it was very lively.
And I'm glad I happened to be next to you at World Fantasy this year.
Yeah, right.
Okay, bye for now.
Okay, and I'll talk to you probably one way or another.
So thanks again to Tim Powers for being such a great guest on this episode of The World Shapers. As you could tell, that was a phone conversation, so it sounds a little different, but the content is just as great as it usually is with the wonderful authors I have spoken to on the podcast. Just a reminder that this is Kickstarter month for The World Shapers, specifically for an anthology called Shapers of World, featuring many authors from my first year of the World Shapers, if it funds, which I really hope it does, and the campaign is on until noon on March 30th. If it funds, I hope that I will be able to repeat the process next year and do a second anthology, Shapers of Worlds Volume 2, which will feature guests from the second year of this podcast. Just a reminder that The World Shapers is online at theworldshapers.com. It is on Twitter at The World Shapers and on Facebook at The World Shapers Podcast, I think. I can never remember. I should really look that up. But do a search for The World Shapers Podcast, and it's the only one that will turn up. I am also online at edwardwillett.com, EdwardWillett.com, on Twitter at ewillett. You can buy autographed books from me at edwardwillettshop.com. You can find me on Facebook at edward.willett, and I'm on Instagram and trying to do better with it, so you can find that at ecwillett. Just a reminder as well that there are many great guests yet to come. Next week, the last weekend in March, I'll be featuring Ira Naiman. Other guests who are lined up for interviews include Adria Laycroft, Barbara Hambly, Nancy Kress, and Brian Thomas Schmidt. So these are some of the guests that you can look forward to if you continue to pay attention to The World Shapers and follow it. I hope that you will. And again, check out that Kickstarter at tinyurl.com/shapersofworlds, or just go to Kickstarter and search for Shapers of Worlds. That's it for this week. I will be back next week. I don't usually say that because it's usually every 2 weeks, but for this month, I'll be back next week with that episode featuring Ira Naiman. Until then, stay safe and bye for now.